glad to see that we have a great number and we're at the point where we're bringing in extra chairs, which is so much better than trying to do away with chairs so people won't notice that no one's here. My name's Catherine Mead, and welcome to Blackout. I'm black and I'm out, so I guess that's I guess that's how I'm involved this evening. But seriously though, I am very excited about tonight. I have been involved with the anti-racism movement the anti-homophobic movement for over 20 years. So as you can imagine, I was 5 when I was, became an activist. But I have been involved with both movements for over 20 years, and I would say this is the first event that I recall that I've ever attended where we were actually looking at issues of racism within the LGBT community and homophobia within the black community. So I'm really, really thrilled that the organizers of this event created the event, and I'm also thrilled to be participating. Before we continue, just a couple of housekeeping items. First and foremost, I know you might feel like now you're in a movie, but if I could ask you to please, no texting and no phones. So be sure to turn off your phones if you have them, and it's a very easy mistake. So this is your opportunity, because I just want to say, if during the event tonight your phone goes off, people are going to look at you. You had your chance. You can't pretend you didn't know. So yeah, please turn it off or down. And as well, I know that we have a few journalism students here and maybe even folks are with more mainstream media. And just asking folks to remember to ask people before you take pictures, before anyone assaults anyone on our behalf. The media did ask us and we all said we're good, so don't worry. In my life, I've long since learned that just because you're oppressed actually doesn't mean that you understand oppression. And when I was young, my hero, without question, was Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. And what I didn't realize was that later in my life, it would actually be his wife, Coretta Scott King, who would turn out to be my true hero. Because Coretta Scott King got it. She got it. She got that oppression and discrimination are oppression and discrimination. And under no circumstances are either justified or acceptable. Back in April of 1998, Coretta Scott King called on the civil rights community to join in the struggle against homophobia. And she said, "Homophobia is like racism and anti-Semitism and other forms of bigotry, in that it seeks to dehumanize a large group of people and to deny their dignity, their humanity, and their personhood." And she went on to say that this, meaning homophobia, sets the stage for further repression and violence that all too easily victimize the next minority group. But it was her speech in November of 2003 where she unequivocally linked the civil rights movement to the LGBT movement. And she said, rather perplexed, "I still hear people say that I should not be talking about the rights of gay and lesbian people." She said, "But I hasten to remind them that Martin Luther King Jr. said, 'Injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere.' And I appeal to everyone," she went on to say, "I appeal to everyone who believes in Martin Luther King Jr.'s dream to make room at the table of brotherhood and of sisterhood for lesbian and gay people." And those are really, that's a great challenge, and those are really great words from a woman who knows very well and lives through the front lines of the civil rights movement, and she got it. Well, tonight we have a really great panel. I'm really thrilled. Of folks who get it in many instances, and I'm thrilled that we have them here. You'll see to my immediate right is Dr. Clement George. He's an assistant professor at the University of Ontario Institute of Technology in Oshawa. Beside him is Robert Wright. He's a social worker in private practice here in Halifax, and he's a PhD student right here at Dell, and he's doing his PhD in social work. And then on our far end is Chris Cochran, who's a local performer and activist here in the city. Our format tonight is that each panelist is going to speak for about 15 minutes, and then after that we're going to open things up for questions, and that's really the time to ask anything you will and raise issues as you see fit, and we'll see how our night progresses. Our order will be, we'll start first with Robert, then Chris, and bringing us home is going to be Clement. So.
Put me up there.
You're welcome. I would say yes.
Yeah.
For your benefit, not for mine, I'll come here. I want to thank you, Catherine, for the introduction. And I thought I would thank the organizers for inviting me to be here. I speak often in public. I should say a little bit about myself. I am a social worker. I've been a social worker since infancy. have been active and involved in that profession here in Nova Scotia my entire career. So over the last 20-some years, 20 years and just a little bit. So, like I said, since childhood, I've been a social worker. And I've worked, as Catherine and I, colleagues, and I've worked in education, I've worked in community service and child welfare, I've worked in anti-poverty organizations, I've done a fair amount of work. I have not worked in the field, and I worked as the race relations coordinator for the Dartmouth School Board for a time, and so in that setting, I did have a general responsibility for discrimination. I always used to say I was responsible for all the isms and obias when I was there. But this will be the first time that I've actually spoken publicly about being a black gay man. So I thought it was an interesting request for me to be here. So I've really, as part of this, I thought I would start my presentation by simply describing aspects of my biography that may be relevant and interesting as part of our discussion as the evening goes on. And then I thought I would read a bit from a text that I prepared, I guess, 5 or 6 years ago now, as a bracketing exercise. Bracketing is a thing that social scientists do, or some of us do, to personally investigate and externalize an issue that is part of our own personal experience prior to investigating that issue scientifically or professionally. So I actually was asked to participate in a conference on issues of male victimization in domestic relationships. And because that issue was still hot and heavy with me at the time, I had been married and divorced, I thought I needed to do a bit of bracketing around it before I could go on to do some investigating around it. And so sexuality and relationship issues get tied up in that text. And I'll just read a little bit, the first page and the last page, actually, the juiciest parts. So, a little bit about myself personally. I was born the fifth of my mother's six children. She had two girls and four boys in that order. I have other siblings, two children of my father's, and many others who would be meta-siblings, who would be the siblings of my siblings, if you know what I mean. If you're black, you get that. I describe myself as having been raised in a female-headed household. My great-aunt lived with our family since before I could remember until the time of her death. My mother's various partners, some of them our fathers, seemed to be fleeting and insignificant influences in my imagination. I was a bookish kid who enjoyed music, who sang in choirs, who enjoyed religion and things spiritual, and counted girls among my best friends growing up. And like most guys, I had my first experiences exploring sex with other guys. And like most, I didn't allow that to define, confuse, or distress me overly. Though I was fit and athletic all my life, I identified growing up more as a brain than a body. Given that all of my siblings and my nieces and my nephews and my cousins were athletic superstars or had very large physical presence. So although in the land of the blind, the one-eyed man is king, well, in the land of the superstar, the physically adequate has to be bookish to make his way. I surprised some people when, while off to college, I met and married a black woman. And I guess that some were surprised that I partnered with a woman, and others that I partnered with someone black. Not that I would have been described as anti-black as a youth by any means, but because I think many perceived that my tastes were white. I'm not going to investigate that too deeply now. Like I said, I'll just share this, and when we get talking, it'll all come up, I'm sure. I described myself as having been rather tolerably married. I stayed 12 years in a marriage that probably had a shelf life of 4, and staying mostly out of duty to my daughter, out of religious views about relationships and marriage, and out of duty to a wife whose health was fragile. I guess throughout my youth and early adulthood, I had come to acknowledge that I could be with men as easily as I was with a woman, though I didn't venture down that road until after my separation. I'll confess that after my marriage ended, I found casual relationships with men a lot easier. Casual hookups, friends with benefits, friendly fun, uncomplicated. I've even enjoyed the sexual energy of bathhouses in several cities in North America, though I've never been to our local establishment. I guess the possibility of running into a naked colleague or a former teacher or worse even a current student just seems a bit too much for me to bear. Though I've worked in anti-discrimination and been an identified ally in many settings, I've taught about human sexuality. I'm even a bona fide expert in some areas of human sexuality. I'm getting bona fide now, Robin will say. I have a brother who died of AIDS and would often be around the old office of the PWA when my ex-wife worked there as office manager. Despite all that, I've never been active in the queer community. Being queer has surprisingly not been the most pressing or oppressing issue in my life thus far. Perhaps it's because I came out long after the hard fights had already been fought and won. Perhaps because my identity as a black man was already consuming all of my time on the equity front. Perhaps because my identity as a dedicated single parent, or as a church man, or as a clinician, or as a G-man, I work for the government off and on, or whatever, left no place for the queer part of my identity to take precedence. Or perhaps because despite being out, I'm still neurotically closeted. Perhaps participating in this panel will be a step towards understanding what space queer can play in my multitude of identities, identities that are sometimes dramatically at war with each other, but never, ever quite at peace. Now, if you'll allow me, I'd like to read 2 pages from the text I mentioned earlier, the first and last page. It's titled Wrestling with Angels, and I won't try to explain that now. It was written by my best friend, Naren Holtz, who some of you might know, who actually introduced Robin Metcalf and I, my partner Robin Metcalf up here in the front. And she wrote the text after a full day of interviews, and so here's the text, Wrestling with Angels. This won't take but a minute. Curtis reached toward the package of condoms on the hotel night table and tore open the foil package. He hadn't thought he could perform again, but between Ricky's naughty boy smile and the playful roughhousing with a male whose body was as cut as modern architecture, Curtis found a reserve of desire. Ricky was the first black man Curtis had slept with, but despite their common skin color, Curtis doubted they would become friends. Listening to Rick complain about his boss at the shoe store and his failed aspirations in his chosen field made Curtis feel as if he was with one of his clients. His clients fared worse in life, but their aggrieved tone was much the same. Ricky sat up and placed his hand in the middle of Curtis's chest and pushed ever so slightly while staring up at him with huge brown eyes that contained a mixture of defiance and vulnerability. Curtis was disconcertingly reminded of his daughter on the rare occasion she misbehaved. "You don't have to wear it," Ricky said. Curtis felt himself wither in his palm. "You're kidding me." He stood up and tossed the condom into a waste paper basket. He put on his boxers and sat on the bed. What to do? He didn't want to throw Ricky out in a dramatic scene, but he didn't have time for this kind of foolishness. He had had enough foolishness with his ex-wife, Paula. What had his mother said to him once about Paula? "She wanted to bring you down to her level." Curtis was not going to be infected by this pretty man. As his daughter liked to say, deja vu all over again. The men Curtis had sex with since his divorce were sometimes impatient with his reluctance to join the gay flock, to wave a rainbow flag at a pride parade, or even tell his mother. "I'm not neurotically closeted," Curtis said. "There's no such thing as being in the closet non-neurotically," the man retorted. "Face it, you're a fag." Curtis didn't answer. He could have told the man he had no problem performing with his wife, that he hadn't had romantic coffees with men during his marriage, or gone in for any type of foolishness in parks then. Unlike Paula, he had never done anything he had to cover up in his marriage. He knew his church would say that he was now in the embrace of demons, but he would put it differently. He had wrestled the angel on his shoulder that always exchanged the soft currency of his feelings for the hard currency of duty. He was free now and wanted to stay that way. The appeal of men was their willingness to keep it simple, to not insist on meeting his daughter and starting a family. What was that old song? Men pay prostitutes not to have sex, but to go away. The men who like men don't need to hire professionals if they aren't too old and ugly. And Curtis knew that he was a catch who refused to be thrown down by anyone. So that's my introduction.
I guess you could say that I'm the unprofessional of the professional panel tonight. I was asked to come here to talk to you guys about transgendered youth, black youth, and also just being a gay person from a small community. As some of you might know, or some of you might not know, I am a transgendered woman. 4 years ago, I was in the Navy, and I decided to leave the Navy because I thought that I wasn't fulfilling the dreams and fulfilling my life the way I thought I should be fulfilling it. So, reluctant to me, even though I did like the Navy, it was not a career that I think I could have forced myself to continue with. So, I left the Navy and I started my therapy. I started my hormone treatment about 2 years ago, and I've been doing that ever since. Although, that is not what I'm known for in this community. Most people know me as Elle Noir, as you've probably seen on the poster. Elle Noir is a stage performer that I started 5 years ago, actually when I started the Navy. I was crowned Miss Gay Halifax when I was in my last year of the Navy, to the Navy's disbelief. I thought it was going to be a lot harder for me to leave the career that I've chosen for myself, but as I found out when I started my therapy and I started to realize that this is what I want to do with my life, that it was a lot easier for me to be a transgender woman in my life than it was to be a gay repressed male in the Navy. Also, to most of my family's unwavering confidence in me, I was known as the golden boy in our family. So when I was younger, I was the one who always got the straight A's. I was always the one who was the reasonable person in the house. I was the one who always stayed in. I was the one who always did their homework. Unfortunately for me, I was a 352-pound child. Like some most gay youth, some use abuse for themselves. Me, I did a lot of eating, a lot of self-eating, a lot of self-medication. So at a very young age, I started eating. I also started drinking. I also started doing other things because I didn't know how myself to deal with it. So I started internalizing a lot of my problems. As I went through the years, my family would hint to me that they knew that I was gay, but not fully come out. It wasn't until I was in my 12th year of school, grade 12, when I came to my parents and I finally said, "Mom, Dad, I'm sorry to tell you this, but I think I might be gay." My mother gave me the look of, "Well, duh, child." For years, you asked for a blow dryer when you were 7, we gave it to you. We know. Then again, 2 years ago, I had to go back to that same woman who was so pleasing to me, but still I was feeling very internalized again, thinking, I don't know how she's going to react to this, because now, not only was I telling her that I was a gay man, I was telling my mother, who's known me all of my life, even before I was born, now that I wanted to be a woman. So I thought about this for 6 to 8 months. I started my hormones, I started my therapy, before I even went to talk to my mother. So it was Easter weekend, a year and a half ago. I decided, this is the year that I'm coming out. I'm gonna tell my mother, I don't want to be a man anymore, I want to be a woman. So again, I got up all the confidence, I went to my mother, and I finally said, during Easter dinner, instead of calmly saying it, because as most people know, if they know me, I'm a very flamboyant person, and I usually blurt out stuff without thinking. I yelled out, "Mom, I don't want to be a man anymore. I want to be a woman. I've already started the treatment. I've already started everything." And to my delight and to my anger, she said, "Okay, dear, that's fabulous. Would you like potatoes?" I was actually very angry at my mother for about 2 weeks. I didn't talk to her when I went home. I didn't talk to her. I was like, how could she accept this so easily? For me, it took me 2 years to accept this before, well, almost 18 years to accept this, to be who I was, and she was willing to accept it. She finally asked me why I was so angry with her, and I said, well, I've been struggling with this for so long. How can you be so confident in it and so quiet and so easy to talk about it? And she said, it doesn't matter what you are. It's always what you're going to be and what you're going to become. If you're happy in your own life and you're not hurting anyone, then that's exactly what I think you should be. So that's what I come to talk to you guys about, is that it's not always the easiest of things, even when you have a family like mine, because I sometimes take it for granted. When I see my other friends, I can't go home during Easter, I can't go home during Christmas, and even talk about that they just got this new boyfriend that they want to talk to everybody about, but when they go home, they have to be the straight-laced, very straight, you know, boy, you know, the golden boy, the golden girl. I take that for advantage. As a small child, living up in a predominantly black community, obviously, as you can see, I'm not fully black, as people would say. I'm mixed race. I had a white mother, and I have a Chinese African father. The problem that I've had for my whole life was that I was always stuck in the middle for everything. When I was younger, I wasn't white, and I wasn't black, so I'm right in the middle. Now, as an adult, I'm not a man, and I'm not a woman. Again, I'm stuck right in the middle. So my whole life, it's always been feel like I'm in the center, and there's people on either side of me that are equals, but are not exactly what I am. Just this year, actually, I started talking to transgender youth. I started talking to people that are just starting to understand what's coming to them. They're not necessarily just a gay woman anymore, or just a gay man, but they think that they're another person inside of another person's body. I started talking to gay people when I was in the Navy. The last time I was at a panel like this, I was a black man who was still struggling to come out in the gay community. Unfortunately, like like I said, being in the Navy, we might not have the don't ask, don't tell policy up in Canada, but it's a lot more egregious up here because instead of coming right out and saying we're not going to accept you because you're gay, we hide it behind all the cloak and dagger and pretend that it's just, we don't deal with that up in Canada. We're very open-minded, but I can tell you very much right now that the military is still very close-minded. It's still very a white man, big man's world. It's still very the old boys club. And even for the women that are in the community, it was hard for them to be in the Navy. For me to be able to go to work like this, when I just a few short weeks beforehand, I was coming as a man in my uniform, it was going to be a different change. So I released from the military and I moved to Toronto, which I thought was going to be a good choice for me. You know, there's a lot of transgender community out there, of course. When I moved out there, I found out it wasn't as easy as that. The problem being with in a community that is so large as Toronto is that there's more of us. There's more transgendered people. So there's more of, I guess, a competition, but there's more doctors out there, but there's a lot more of those people that are trying to get to those doctors. Out here in Halifax, we have one doctor, and then we have about two therapists that deal with transgendered youth and transgender community. Even though that there's only three people that deal with it, it feels like it's a lot more accepting, a lot more easier out here, because now instead of having seven doctors that you might meet once every 3 years, you're now meeting one person one-on-one, and they know your history, and they also know what you're going to be for your future. So it's a lot easier for them to deal with it. So that's the reason why I moved back to Halifax. Also, my family's back here, my friends are back here, and they welcome me with open arms. So you want to be with people that, if you're going to be making a life-changing decision like that, you want to be around people that you know that are going to be there with you 100%, because even though you might have friends that you've met and you've known for a year up in Toronto, this is where your family is. This is where the people that have stood by you since you were kids, since you were the gay man, since you were the gay drag queen, it's a lot easier to deal with. It's a lot easier to talk to them about it. So I moved back here. When I moved back here, I decided that I wasn't going to do L anymore because now I'm a transgender woman, and really, drag, there's still the whole thing of, well, if you're going to be a transgender woman, you can't be a drag queen anymore. So there was the whole debate with me and also with other people. I decided after about 5 months of being annoyed and being called constantly and being told, L, we want you to come do this, L, we want you to come do that, I had a big voice. I realized that I had a big voice in the community as being a drag queen. So I decided to go back to L, not only just to perform, but also to project myself into the community again, because if I had this big voice as El Noir, then I'll be able to get to what I want to talk about as a transgender woman. So it was a lot easier for me to come back, start talking as El. So that's why most people call me El. That's why you saw my name as poster as El Noir. A lot of people still can't see the point of calling me Chris. It's because they've been calling me El for the last 5 or 6 years. I don't have a problem with people calling me El anymore, except for like when I'm at work or something like that. I don't mind if they call me El. It's just my close friends, I've been pushing on them for the last year or so to call me Chris, to identify with me, the person, not the performer that's on stage. So a lot of people think that just because of my age, I'm only 25 years old, that I've not been educated enough, or I don't have enough wisdom to be able to come up and talk about the different things. But when you think about what I've done in my life, I've been to 27 different countries. I'm a transgendered woman. I'm Chinese, African, Native, and Acadian. I've had it all. For somebody who's only in their 25 years, I've done more in my 25 years than most people will do in their 50s and 60s. I've seen more things, I've done more things, I've talked more panels, I've done more in my 25 years than most people can do in their 40s. The only problem that I have with when I get up and start speaking publicly is that I think that people think that, well, you know, it's just a drag queen. She doesn't really have any thoughts. you know, she's just there as an entertainment purpose. But you have to think, as I was talking to Catherine before, that, he said, he asked me about, do I think the difference between entertainment and being a drag queen and being a speaker? You have to have confidence in what you do with anything that you do. So if you're going to get out and entertain, you also have to get out and speak your mind. And those two have to collide, because if you can't physically get up here and talk to people about your own transgender youth or about your own self, and then you go out and perform, you're basically hiding behind that performance. So what you have to do is you have to be able to separate the two, which I'm trying to do right now, is that when I'm Elle, that's great, I'm on stage, I'm performing, I love people cheering and stuff like that. But when I'm out doing stuff like this, I like people to listen to me, I like people to understand where I come from and what I do, because it is two different things. Elle the entertainer and Chris Cochran the person are two different people. Elle is known in Halifax, God help me, as the bitch of Halifax. It's not by choice, it's a lot basically because of my appearance. And it's mainly because a lot of people are intimidated to talk to me because of my big stature or the confidence that I have in myself, so they would rather just project that image on me as a bitch than actually come up and talk to me as a person. Also, it's not that easy sometimes being that person, because if I left my guard down, then people are just gonna walk right over me. So I fed into that persona for so many years now that a lot of people just think that's just the way I am. So being able to talk on panels like this is just being able to get my voice out there and show, well, actually I'm not that type of person, it's just a person that you see on stage. I'm pretty sure Monica on Friends is not exactly what she is when she's out in public. It's you have to be able to distinguish the both of them between us. So what I'm here today to talk about any transgender youth, actually gay youth, anything. I guess I'm the voice of reason for the younger community of today. So thank you for listening, and hope you have some questions later.
Well, I should say that, thank you for having me. Happy to be here, and it was really good to hear the different stories, which are quite diverse, and also quite diverse, quite different from mine. I could say probably I'm one of the outsiders, because God, I came out since I was 6 years old. Well, no, that's not true, but I came out a long time ago, so my story is not as interesting. But anyway, I want to talk about a different issue here. I know that we're not talking about HIV per se, but mm-hmm. we're just talking about the intersection between gender and race and ethnicity. Because I am, by training, I'm an epidemiologist, and I did my work, and I should say I'm a social epidemiologist. I did most of my work with gay men in Montreal, and then moved to Toronto to do the rest of my work, which is basically community-based research, whereby we're taking the issues of communities and what communities have defined for us, and basically trying to move towards what we call a social justice endpoint. Moving towards something that is going to improve the life of individuals. So my talk is going to be around addressing a health disparity in Toronto area amongst African and Caribbean or Black men. And there might be a few words or terms that I might use tonight, and I hope it's not offensive to anyone. For example, I will say Black to be very inclusive, African, Caribbean, etc. I will use the term black men who have sex with men to include gay, bisexual, transgender, etc. And it's just an all-encompassing term. I may use the word gay at times, but please, it's just a word. It's just a term. There isn't much value at this point in trying to debate the issue, because I do know that gays and lesbians, transgender, etc., have fought a long fight to be called gay, and it is devaluing to use the term men who have sex with men. I do know that, and I do understand it. But for ease of talking and to be inclusive as possible, I will use terms such as these. So one of the issues that we face, or people in black people in Toronto face, is the issue of HIV, which is becoming very important to not just black men, but to black women and to many of our communities. As you know, the HIV epidemic began in Canada, more around the what we say the four H's: hemophiliacs, heroin addicts, Haitians, homosexuals. So for many reasons, people coming from the Caribbean or Africa, or being born here, have disassociated themselves with the epidemic. It's quite easy to understand that for many people here, there are many issues, such as in Nova Scotia, issues of segregation. In Ontario, the issue of acculturation, trying to fit in. There are economic issues as new immigrants trying to settle in into a new country, etc. So there are many burdens that are already pressing, and people, because of that, do not really want to add an extra burden on themselves by associating themselves with something as HIV. And because of that, we haven't seen much action, or there hasn't been much action in the black community around that issue. And as a result, and that may be as a result, I can't say that, we've seen increasing rates of HIV in the black community in Ontario and in other parts of Canada. So because of that, there is a group of individuals who came together and they formed an organization called the HIV Endemic Task Force, which sort of morphed later on into what we call the African and Caribbean Council on HIV and AIDS in Ontario, OACHO. Now, OACHO came up with a strategy to address HIV, and in the community, because of the increasing rates, which was about moving communities together to talk about the issue, and also the politicians to talk about the or to recognize the issue. You have organizations who are there to serve the needs of black people, but they haven't been serving the needs because there is basically no data to support it. So one of the things about OACHO was to get the politicians, etc., to talk about it and to provide the sort of funding for it. So for working with the groups and individuals, etc. So, but one of the things that OACHO did not talk about, and we can come back to the area, the issue of, I don't want to call it homophobia, but somehow in looking at that issue of HIV, gay men weren't really mentioned. It came in afterwards. But while we were talking, while the issues was, people were trying to address the issue, they forgot to add in the issue of gay men, so black men who have sex with men. So here we have a strategy that basically is supposed to help in the reduction of HIV infection, but at the same time, we're not targeting one of the the highest group who's infected or affected by the disease. So there are some of us, like myself, who were in ACHO and said, we do need to address it. And we worked together as a group to apply for funding to look at, basically, we call a study, getting to know the community, who are the black men who have sex with men? Because here we are in Toronto, not knowing very much about black men who have sex with men in the city. That study was funded by CIHR, and the results, we now have the results. But that study, I'll just talk a little bit about it in terms of the objectives of that study. We wanted to characterize black men who have sex with men in Toronto, and to characterize them, we needed to know basically who are the gay, who are the bisexuals, who are the transgender, etc. Because we, as just as black, there is no black community, but we have communities of community. It's in the same way we have several communities within, you know, the sexual array or rainbow. So we needed to know who we are, and to also, of course, to look at correlates of risk behavior, what makes people more at risk for something, and also at the same time, what is protective. Protection is also important. And to examine the differences between our different communities. We also wanted to know, have an idea of the experiences and the influences in sexual decision making. And also we had worked with the provincial government to get a campaign out for not just men who have sex with men or gay men or black men who have sex with men, but the entire black community. So we wanted to know how, what was the impact of that campaign for black men who have sex with men. So how did we do it? It wasn't me as a researcher. We started by talking to, first of all, getting together a community group, a community advisory group, people who are gay, bisexual, and who are transgender, and who actually know about the issues and know about the everyday issues, the experiential evidence that is there. We wanted to have that information from them. Also from key informants, people who have been working with the different populations and had a first-hand knowledge of what's happening. We also conducted surveys, and we also had in-depth interviews. So I'm just going to jump in into what are some of the things that we found out, which is probably some of the things that you would have seen here yourself. From the service provision point of view, these individuals stated that one of the greatest issues that they were having is that the structure of black service organizations and organizations that are there to work with black gay, bisexual, and other men who have sex with men, transgender, and other men who have sex with men, were just not welcoming. They could not enter. They did not feel comfortable in going to these places. Also, that information around HIV education was quite confusing to them, leading to, you know, insufficient knowledge around risk negotiation. I mean, sometimes it's really confusing even to someone like all of us, even at this stage in our life. can you get HIV through a kiss? Sometimes some people say yes, theoretically. Sometimes some people say no. I mean, yeah, there is that, those sort of issues. HIV prevention campaigns, so far that they have seen, were not inclusive of Black folks. So here there were lots of campaigns all over, but Black men and Black folks did not feel, you know, included. And maybe there was, you know, the Marlboro man or something like that, or these, you know, young buffed guys, white guys, up on the poster who look, you know, like something that they couldn't be, and you know, and basically they could not, they didn't feel any kind of attachment to them. I mean, I'm sure many of you have seen these magazines with these handsome men, even Black men too, that none of us can actually look like. Also, there was a sense of isolation amongst Black men who have sex with men, because, and that kind of isolation was not recognized by the service providers. I mean, as I started off, there are multifaceted issues that actually can act upon the psyche of individuals, leading them to social isolation, but yet that wasn't an issue that was being looked at. In terms of the community, individuals found that there wasn't a well-defined support within Black communities. Within Black communities, there was also, what they found out was homophobia was rampant, and institutions exacerbate isolation by creating, and because of that, individuals were fearful of disclosing their sexuality. I mean, hey, we all know it's not just limited to the United States, but for many Black folks, the church is a place that we often look towards for a source of solace or, you know, support. But when this minister is preaching on Saturday or Sunday, saying that you're going to hell, and you know, you're in Sodom and Gomorrah. I don't remember. It's a long time since. I mean, it's yeah. So this is the problem, and within the gay community themselves, individuals found that the gay community, which was framed as a white community, they didn't feel that they were welcome within there. Of course, some men felt that they were exoticized within the community. You know, the Mapplethorpe kind of guy, you know, that sort of thing.
Erotic, exotic.
Exactly. But at the same time, they weren't made to feel like they were people, and this contributed to some of the isolation. And now I just wanted to talk a little bit of some of the results that we got from our in-depth interviews around identity. While there was a sort of community that was fragmented within gay community or gay communities, some men still were able to find a source of making their own connections within gay communities. So what I'm just trying to say is that there was a sense of resilience, and individuals were able to carve out their own niches within communities. So what I'm saying is that it's all is not lost. Individuals are still strong and are able to help themselves. Within the Black communities, they also found Black communities as a sense as a source of strength by drawing basically on what we would call on traits of Black communities, such as certain traits of that is associated with growing up in their home countries or right here in Toronto. For example, something as simple as walking down the street to ask somebody a question. You won't ask that person, you'll feel bad about asking that person a question if you've walked by that person once and not said hello. Well, I mean, this is something that is probably foreign to many people living in North America. We just walk by other people without saying hello, but I guess in Atlantic Canada it's a little bit different, but at least certainly in Toronto. But then going back to them and asking for something, which is quite usual in big cities like Toronto, was kind of foreign to them. But they felt that their upbringing helped them to bridge some of these, divides. So gay Black men struggle with silence and denial and suppression of their gay identities within their own ethno-racial and national communities of origin. And I'm talking more about in the Toronto. And I'm sure it is similar to many people here. Many people are not as fortunate, for example, as Chris, to be able to talk about their sexuality within their family environment or their community environment for fear of being thrown out. I mean, we hear the horrible stories of Jamaicans being murdered or Africans being put in jail just to be with another man. So when you do move to Toronto or the biggest cities, the practices just don't stop. Communities remain similar to what they were practicing. Their practices continue to what was there in the country of origin. Most participants identify that ethno-racial communities do not acknowledge or embrace the wholeness of Black, African, gay, Caribbean men. So that's the thing. You could be one or the other, but you couldn't be everything. And this was an issue for them. And I will just skip to my conclusion to say that there are very complex circumstances that put Black men who have sex with men at risk for, not just HIV, but other health issues. And we should not try to deal with it, these issues in isolation, but we should try to come up with this, I hate to use the word, but for lack of another word, a holistic view. Try to get all of these different issues and put them into perspective when we're trying to meet the needs of these individuals. Also, these men are also, and as we heard tonight, socially proactive and politically vested, and we should use those sorts of strength to push the issue forward. And consider, we also should consider that people are in control of their own lives, have their agency, and that is a way of moving forward to have a better health for Black men who have sex with men. Thank you.
That's great. Thanks, all of you. Thanks very much. And Clement, just so you know, I had a crush on my best friend's mother when I was 5, so we have more in common, I guess, than well, we had a really great range of presentations tonight, actually, from very, very personal experiences that were shared by Robert and Chris, to then getting more of an empirical overview from Clement, which is a great thing, because I think that really gives a really rich field for questions. And so with that, I will turn things to you folks to see if you have any questions of any of our panelists. If you have a question for a specific panelist, just
please reference them by name, and or if you're opening to the entire panel, then let us know. It's the rush of people. So I would ask, great, so I'll ask a couple of things. When you ask your question, please stand, and so we can hear you, and please just give your first name. Or you can make up a name if you want, that's okay.
Makes a lot of sense.
Great.
Yeah. And sorry, although I'm not from Halifax, just from my own personal experience, and I'm sure any member of the panel or right here, Sharon, can jump in and answer your question. But I think one of the issues here is how do we, and you're asking, how do we get to marry those two issues together? And I think the first thing one needs to do is to approach the allies and try to find out from them how it is best to go around doing it. I teach community-based research, and I talk about doing research that is important to the community. It's no way that any work that you're going to do will move forward if the community sees that this is not an issue that is important to them. If you have a lot of time, and you know, like many of us, we do have the time, you can really try to bring that issue forward, whatever you're trying to move forward, as an issue of importance to the community, and then have them take it on as their own, and then we can all move forward. But I think it's best to work with the allies in the community to find out who's there, whether it's the LGBTQII community or the HIV community. I'm sure there are bridges between them, and you have to find those and work with them. Yeah.
Thanks. Did either of you have anything to add? Or?
I certainly have thoughts. If I understand the question is, how do you begin to talk about these things? And I guess I would say that people have to approach the issue with an understanding of the complexities and the layered complexities that it is to be a black man. Okay? So a black man, separate and apart from the queer issues, a black man has to say, okay, am I employed as a black man? Am I employed in the right kind of role as a black man? Am I black enough in my black community? Am I too black to be functional in the other communities in which I exist? This is a question. Am I fulfilling my roles as a black son and brother? And am I dealing appropriately as a black man in a racist society, which means I have to be active enough that I'm black, but not so active as to be dysfunctional. And then you wake up one morning, oh my goodness, I want to have sex with men. okay, now how do I weave that in the tapestry of complexity that it is to be a black man? And the place where all black people go to experience the balm for this complexity, you know, in the lap of Mother Church, is not the place where I can go. So this is, I think, as Clemens said, we need to be able to find a way to deal with the whole. So that a black man who is inquiring about information, or who is going to be approached by individuals in the queer community or people who are involved with the issue around raising awareness around HIV, need to approach that black man with an understanding of the rich complexity that is the black male experience. And not to make it an impossible job, right? Because I run the risk of people saying, well, we just can't do it then. The reality is that black men are dealing with this on a daily basis, and the people who wish to deal with black men need to find ways to approach black men within the context of that complexity. I had a couple of thoughts.
Those are great ones.
And speaking as my friends say, a reformed black man, I think they're both delicate issues, so you have to be able to approach the both of them separately and then to bring them together, because as a black man or as a black woman, the first thing, as soon as people hear of AIDS, it goes straight to gay, even though it's been shown for years that it's not directly just because you're gay, but as soon as the word A comes up, then the straight black man is like, no, that's not me, I can't be because I'm not gay. But if you're not able to deal with them separately, you won't be able to deal with them as a whole, because you have to be able to take the AIDS problem, and you have to be able to take the LGBTQIABCD problem and separate the both of them, because sometimes they're not always together, and that's the problem that a lot of people have, is that once they think of one, they think of the other. So I think you need to separate the both of them for able to talk to them as both.
Excellent. Thanks. Other questions? You know the rules. Stand up. Make up a name.
I'm Kayla. That's my real name. Because I'm wondering the difference between the oppression or discrimination you felt as a gay man opposed to a transvestite. Is that the right word?
Transgender.
Sorry.
As a gay man, I was more or less of being in the black community, being from a God-fearing family. It was a thing that you had to, you were supposed to love God, grow up, marry a woman, have three kids, have the house, have everything else like that. So that was oppressed in that way, was that basically from your family and from your community's view. But being as a transgender woman, it's a little different. Even in the transgender community, I wouldn't say it's biased, but transgender women and transgender men still have a lot of issues with the gay community. The gay community still sees transgendered people as kind of an outside version of the gay people, because not all transgender women end up liking transgendered, end up liking men, or, you know, so there's a lot of issues and there's a lot of diversity within there. So the oppression for the transgender community is that, for me, myself, is that, some of the transgender women see me as, they call me Hollywood, some of them. They see me as that I'm just there for the looks and basically just to be the pretty woman, but it's not just that. So I'm oppressed a little bit with the transgender community because of the way I look and because of the way I act. But when I was a gay man, it was basically the complete opposite. It was because I didn't look like this and I didn't look like that and I didn't act like that. So it's a little bit different for the transgender than it was for me when I was a gay man, especially when I was from a small community. Being from a small community anywhere, so it doesn't matter if they're black, white, Chinese, African, everybody talks, right? So.
Other questions? Yeah.
Th- this is my name is Robin. This isn't really a question, but it's just a piece of information I had to share because of the date that we're meeting on, which is the 30th of November, which of course is the eve of World AIDS Day, but it's also the 12th anniversary tonight of the death of Simon and Cody. And I wanted to mention his name because Simon, whose name you may not know to everyone in the audience, but Simon and Cody was the first out gay black African anti-apartheid activist. He was one of the Delmas 22, and when they were imprisoned under the apartheid regime, some of the two other members of the Delmas 22 became sexually involved. Two men became involved with each other, and there was a threat of division among the Delmas 22 on the basis of homophobia, and as a result of that, Simon came out and made fighting homophobia an integral part of his fight against apartheid. And so he became really the first important black African anti-apartheid, anti-homophobia activist, and also later leading AIDS activist in South Africa. And he's one of the people we probably have to thank for the fact that that South Africa was the first country in the world to have sexual orientation included as protected in its constitution. So it's just interesting to me that tonight's panel is happening on the night of the 12th anniversary of his death. I'd like to honor Simon and Cody's memory.
Thank you.
The youth group that as you're a part of, that's basically it for youth in Canada and Nova Scotia. There really isn't a place for Chinese or black or ethnic races to go to, and that's one of the things that I think that needs to change in Halifax, because it's hard enough to be a gay youth and to come out to the youth project as a white person, but picture being from North Preston or from down in Goddington Street, where it is very black predominant. You don't want to be seen going into the gay youth center in case you don't want people to know that you're coming out or that you can't come out because of the community that you're in. So we need to have a safe harbors for people that are in the ethnic community that can come out and talk amongst other ethnic people, because it's a little bit harder. I'm not saying that it's hard for white gay youth to come out, but also it's a little bit harder for the ethnic gay youth to come out. So I think we need to actually start installing a little bit more with them. I actually have been in talks with a few of black gay youth and also black gay educators in Nova Scotia to get that started, to get a reform, to get a place for they can come and they can talk and they can release without having the pressures of people knowing exactly where they are. Not basically almost like an AA where you can come talk and not have anybody judge you for who you are or feel, well, as soon as I walk out of this building, there's gonna be 17 black men across the street and they're gonna know exactly what I'm doing in here and I'm gonna get fed up as soon as I leave here. So I want to find a safe harbor for people that are ethnic, but right now there really isn't any, sorry to say that, but there really isn't in place any ethnic gay youth projects.
Well, I'm sorry. To be, part of that would be that there really isn't a critical mass of racialized groups in the gay and lesbian community, I would say. So. Although I used to be like the only one when I grew up. Now there's like three or four others. I don't know where they came from. I don't feel so special anymore when I go out. But that's really. There's a friend of mine who's the Asian lesbian, and people tend to know us by name because there aren't that many of us, right?
Well, up until about a year ago, I was the only ethnic drag queen from Montreal over. There's no one in Nova Scotia, there's no one in Newfoundland, there's no one in New Brunswick or PEI. So when I go to other provinces, people are like, oh, that's the black drag queen from Halifax. It's the first thing that comes to their mind, because there really isn't a lot. And even when I'm working at Reflections and working at Men's Bar, working in, even looking around here, there isn't, even though this is called Blackout, there really isn't that many blackout tonight. I have to say.
There's some blacks that are out. We don't know if they're out. They're just out.
But so the critical mass isn't there really in sort of, if we call it the older adult community, and therefore to then be able to create something for racialized youth, it gets a little problematic.
Yeah.
And the ones of us who are out, we're busy.
Mm-hmm.
It's five of us, we've all got something to do. But you do, Owen, raise a good point that you're noting about, that plays it out. And it's something that you noted a moment ago, Chris, that I hadn't really thought of, is the placement of the youth project, which it's just fantastic that they actually own a house in Brunswick. On Brunswick Street, the unfortunate thing is that that's right in
the predominantly
black communities, and therefore sliding in and sliding out aren't so easy. But ultimately, there can be ways around it. But great question. Oh, sorry, Robert.
No,
sorry.
I'm just musing. A couple of things, I guess. I always jokingly, in some other work that I do, talk about this whole critical mass question, right? And that, you know, if you're in Toronto, you can have a clinic for left-handed ethnic transvestites, whatever, because there's a critical mass. But I think that this question for us here in the East is really a question for all of the services, for all of the kinds of things that we do. And I'm not just talking about in the queer community or related to HIV. We have to ask the question, how do we serve the kid who has autism living in Advocate Harbor, right? How do we serve the kid who is, an amputee who's living in Tuscan? You know, just because there isn't a critical mass doesn't mean that people have to be marginalized or excluded. And so we have to turn our creative Nova Scotian, we look after our own energy to how do we do this? And I don't know if I have an answer other than we certainly need to ensure that there are allies and advocates for everyone everywhere. For everyone everywhere. And sometimes that takes effort, because of course the first thing you want, there's a principle in cross-cultural work that the closer we are, the easier it is for us to work together. So if I'm a gay, black male, I'd love the person who's my advocate to be a black, gay male, right? If I'm a black, gay, urban male, it would be great if that person were also urban. And if that I was a black, gay, urban, tall man, well, you know, but the more further apart we are, the more difficult it is for us to work. And that only means that we have to work harder at it. So I have been in places the ally for teachers whose first language was French, who were employed in all English schools, and they needed an ally to help them in that transition. And I have had to create myself in the role of ally to that individual. You know? French is not my first language. I'm not Acadian. I don't even look Acadian. But I had to educate myself about their issues, reach out to them, let them know that I understood their issues. I had to educate myself not at their
on their dime. You know, sometimes we do that. I want to be your ally. Help me to be your ally. Tell me everything I need to know to be your ally. Well, you know, then I don't have an ally. I have a student and one more job, right? So I think that it's possible, and I think that we need to do that. And let's not discount that there has been some work done in this area in the past. You know, Kim Wood was employed in with a project with PWA back in the early 90s. There have been other initiatives. We need to find ways to keep that momentum, and we need to kind of get, you know, black endorsements on our ally cards, right? So that we can be those, the allies to those folk.
That's an excellent point. As you said, advocacy. The problem with advocacy is that there's a lot of people that don't want to be the first one to come up in front of people and to say, you know, I'm a black, gay, transgendered woman, and I'm here to speak for all of them, because some of them want to just, you know, want somebody else to go. So that's the problem, is that everybody's waiting for somebody else to do it. So you have to be able to thrust yourself into that, to that view, because if you're waiting around for somebody else to do something for you, you'll be waiting for a long time. So unless you be able to push yourself into that, or at least help somebody else to get into that role, then you're not really helping yourself either. So that's what I think the problem with it sometimes with advocacy is that a lot of people don't want to do it first. So if you don't want to do it first, at least somebody help somebody so they can have a word, so you can have a word at what you want to talk to about.
Yeah. Does anyone know anything? There used to be a black queer group in town called Juka, I believe.
It doesn't exist anymore.
No, but does anyone know anything about its history?
My uncle, he's been living with HIV since he was 18. Used to be a part of it. The problem was is that, as you were saying, is that there wasn't enough closeness. There was a broad view of African, and it was mostly male predominated, so they didn't accept a lot of the lesbian black gay youth, and they didn't accept a lot of people that were mixed race and stuff like that. They had a small generalized people, so that's what it finally just disbarred, because there wasn't enough people that wanted to go into it, and there was also not enough people to advocate for them. So
other questions?
Alright,
Brenda. Oh, well, I shouldn't give your name. You might
want to
say your name, Edna.
No, that's not my name. My name's Brenda. I'm just curious, I'm struck by the complexities that you guys have discussed. And as an educator in the health professions and in occupational therapy, I would say we're 90%+ women, predominantly white, Atlantic Canadians. And I think, how do we as educators best prepare our students to engage in a client-centered manner, in a skillful way, to come to understand the complexities of the healthcare needs in the black community, and then add on to that the black queer community? I'm just curious if you can think of any strategies for us as educators.
I would say this being what we're doing here right now, invite people into the classroom to talk to your students. Have discussions, like, you know, take a day and have just discussions on what is out there and what's out there for not just for white, but also for transgendered, for the black community. It's basically a lot of talking. If you don't talk to your, when I was younger, I was always asking questions. I was one of those kids in classroom that the kids hated, because the teacher, I would ask the questions and we get more homework and stuff like that. But that's the problem, is that some people don't want to talk to the youth. They just want them, oh, here's a pamphlet or here's a book, read this. So basically, talk. There's nothing stronger than actually sitting down with your classmates or sitting down with students or sitting down with people that are your own age and talking about the issues that arise, because if no one talks about it, then it's just a viewpoint, right?
Echo Chris's comments. One of the things I think that if you want to engage individuals, you have to engage them on their own turf, and also make them feel that you are, you know, doing so in a meaningful way and in a respectable way, etc. In my classroom, whenever I do that sort of thing, I always do invite community members to my class, but also try to, for example, give them an honorarium or pay for parking, etc., etc. All of these things show that you appreciate the information that they are bringing to the classroom. In terms of students' work, for example, I do ask students to, although I know there are certain ethical and legal issues about students going into communities, but there is something I'm sure you probably have heard of called service learning, and you know, try to get students and the institution and the community agency that you're working with be on a sort of partnership basis, whereby everybody is providing something for somebody and everybody is benefiting from it. In that way, I think that they get a very good firsthand knowledge of the issues, and to see things from the perspectives of the group of groups that they're working with. I think that although we have like an academic, you know, endpoints that we want to attain, but at the same time we have to encourage students to engage with communities in ways that communities can absolutely benefit from that kind of work. And I do know that on one hand, we're saying that we want to help communities, but yes, I always say to students, and I say to other people too, that I don't like people to talk about the fact about helping in the same way that I do not like the word empowerment being thrown around, because those are things that empowerment, for example, is not something that we can give to somebody, but is something that individuals can earn by themselves or come to that stage by themselves, and we have to provide the steps in order for them to reach that those places. So, you know, send students to communities to engage with them, not to help them, or in such a way that the dialogue is sort of equal and respectful. Because I know that it's just like in the Aboriginal communities, they do not like the idea of people coming to take from them and not giving back. In the same way, I'm sure that in many Black communities, people feel that they do not want to be put up somewhere on a pedestal, or not a pedestal, but as a looking glass, but they want to be engaged in a way that can move them forward with their dignity, yeah, intact.
Sharon in the audience there. I always, when you're present and I'm talking about cultural competence, I always feel like the junior member. I guess what I would say is there are all kinds of things that the practitioner can do, and that's about developing cultural competence. It's about, I think that even if I am not really educated about a particular population, there are things that I can do in my practice that let everybody know walking through the door that this is a place that accepts a broad range of people, right? So if you walk into a place and it is culturally sterile, then it appeals to no one.
if you walk into a place and it is clearly culturally defined, then it is a place for those people.
Right.
If you walk into a place and there's a humanist, diverse, rich, humane setting with genuinely friendly, engaging, and interested people, then that gives me a space in which I can say, I don't know if these people like black people or queer people, but this feels like a place that's friendly. Right? So I mean, this is kind of the basis of beginning cultural competence. But I wouldn't want to lay the burden of that just on the practitioners and the educators. I think that people need to say, why is our faculty so white? People need to say, why is our profession so white? People need to say, why is it that the last few ethnic, queer, or other practitioners who came through this place didn't stay but a season? You know? And we need to really interrogate that on the system level as well as on the practice level. And we need to actually begin to believe that there's something wrong with systems that overly employ one group of people. We actually have to believe that there's something wrong with that. So, for example, if you had a program that failed 80% of its population, I mean, someone would hit a panic button, the train would stop, I mean, the presidents and heads of finance would come running to figure out what the problem was. But if you have a program that has never graduated an ethnic individual in its history, people say, well, why aren't black people interested in X profession? Why don't queer people pursue this profession? What's wrong with them that they aren't? One of the principles around cultural competence is, before you start to think that other people are crazy, maybe you should think that you're stupid. And I mean, it's Elmer Holstein made a quote that's much more eloquent than that, but I've been told in my teaching I should be more colloquial. So does that make sense in terms of how I, anyway, so.
No, thank you.
I don't mean to comment on every question. I can let some pass me by without swinging.
No, it's great to hear from everyone, actually. Sharon, well, yes, everyone's referenced you anyway, so.
I knew this was coming, and I didn't say anything about it in my comments because I knew it was coming up. I really struggle with it because I think that it's interesting both being a visible and an invisible minority. You know, when you're a visible minority, you don't hear the racist jokes. Because
they said when you leave the
right
room.
There, yeah, right. Because but when you're an invisible minority, you hear. And I guess I would say that the homophobic ethic that seems to, or we think pervades the black community, to me seems rooted first in the black church. I mean, I grew up a black Baptist.
I always say in the Black Baptist tradition, because we weren't a church-going family, but we were certainly Baptist. And then I became a Seventh-day Adventist, which is kind of like a Baptist that goes to church on Saturday, only with more prickly edges,
yeah.
I think,
yeah.
in some ways.
More fundamentalist.
Right, yeah,
yeah,
a little more fundamentalist, yeah, 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 on that grand continuum of fundamentalism. So, yeah, the church has not been a friendly place for gay folk. At the same time, I think that black folk have a real history of being loving and accepting of everybody in the community. So it's a really complex thing where there is no space in the black community to talk about the black gay, you know, queer and black, at the same time that people who are queer and black, in my experience, often find the love of their mother is not overly confused. The black mother can go to church every Sunday morning and visit their black son in prison every Sunday afternoon and, you know, go shopping with their black queer son during the week. And, you know, there's this complexity in our, so there is a homophobia in the, what I would say in the discourse, but often love and acceptance in the relationship. And I'd be honest with you, I've been black all my life and probably queer all my life, and I haven't figured it out. If that makes sense.
Yeah, well, it makes sense to me because it mirrors my experiences. So
right.
So,
but I'll say this: that it is awfully hard to sit in the pew with people in a community where you know people love you on one level, but they're still trying to chase the demons out of you on the
other.
And that, it just is. You know, in my own, I mean, I've been a church man. I've been a church man. In the church, I have served in every office you want to imagine. I've served at the local, the regional, the national, the international level. I've preached in more places than I've married people. I've buried people. I've done everything in the church you'd want. And yet now I'm marginalized. Right? So I don't sing in church. I don't preach in church. I stood and gave a testimony once in church that generated an email by one brother that went to every single church member. It was by error. It was actually forwarded that way to the list. I thought it was hilarious, really. So I think that that's kind of a challenge for us, that the discourse is homophobic, and it makes being in the black community and having those relationships a little crazy making.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I would say amen.
Yes. you can still get a witness.
Yeah. That's right. Do I hear a witness?
Still get a witness.
And I would actually say, although I said I was the moderator, and I am. My experiences are very similar to yours. My father's a Baptist minister. No, and I was actually groomed for ministry myself until I came out and realized that is so not going to happen. But you're right about the discourse and the individual and how that's very different, right? And I'm a number of years ago now, I thought, well, you know, I'm going to go back. I was here, and I'll go back to some of the churches that my father had served in here. They're in Toronto now. And so I went to Zion. I just drove there one Sunday and had no idea what was going to, okay, and no kidding, as God is, well, God is my witness. the minister that, just on the Sunday I happened to be there, it's Blair Gross, and he was saying, started off his sermon like, brothers and sisters, some of you as Christians are in the closet. Now, there are some things in the closet should stay in the closet. Oh, amen, amen, amen. But you as Christians, you should come out of the closet, you know. And at least three times during the service, made it very clear, listen, we're gays and lesbians, we don't want to hear about it, right? But, you know, and how that somehow weaved into a given sermon. And then, I don't know, 3 weeks later, I go to one of our other former churches, and it was back, way back in the days of Roseanne Skoke, and wasn't that guy using the pulpit that day? And I want you to sign a petition that's in the back that was supporting this nutcase liberal MP who was actually, she was against having provisions for hate crimes against gays and lesbians, having those kind of provisions in the criminal act, and he was using the pulpit as, you know, to sign it. Now, you don't have to sign it if you don't want to. God knows what you decide. I'm sorry. Oh, Lord. So you have those experiences, absolutely. And I sit in church. I won't say every Sunday, but I sit in church fairly regularly, and really wonder what people are thinking to my left and my right, because I'm fairly out. And yet, here's what I can tell you. Reverend and Mrs. Mead couldn't possibly love me more. Mm-hmm. I can tell you that my aunt and uncle, very well known in the Black Baptist community here, Reverend Bryant and like Helen, my partner Rita's back there. Half the time I didn't know, I'd be like, you know, are you coming? Is Rita there? Is she coming too? You know, she was, it's like, yeah, but no, I said, I'm coming. And my aunt, when we told her we were getting married without missing a beat, and she was 81 at the time, but honestly, we said, you know, well, and we were, do we tell her, blah, 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 blah. Well, praise the Lord, I'm so happy. I swear to God, that was her response, yeah. Right? And then I have this, as I was mentioning to Dane earlier, I had a believe it or not, Republican card-carrying member, Southern Baptist aunt in the U.S. in Florida, who couldn't possibly love me more. And so you're right, we do have these, you know, individually, there's all kinds of things, and on the broader level, there are other things. So it is hard to, you know, we talk about generalizing, because I'm sure, for example, Sharon, some of that's probably frustrating to hear, because like, I'm black and I'm not that way, and so-and-so is black and they're not that way, and so, you know, so to suggest that, you know, the black community is particularly homophobic, and yet, you know, some of the statistical information that speaks to Prop 8 in the U.S. in California was, mm-hmm, because so many blacks were coming out to vote for Obama, and then that's how Proposition 8 on gay marriage went ahead, right? So these are some of the crazy making statistics about our community. I don't know if either of the two of you have something to add to that.
Actually, from being from a small community, I was from an even smaller black community. I actually didn't see any problems with being accepted as a gay individual in a small community. It wasn't until I moved to Vancouver and Halifax and Toronto where I saw that the black communities were so, I wouldn't say vengeful, but more, as you guys were saying, hatred towards the gay community. Yes, you're gay, you can do whatever you want, but don't bring it into my house or don't bring it into my church. When I was younger, my uncle, this man is the gayest thing I've ever met in my entire life. You know, the blonde hair, the fishnet, everything, all that stuff. He used to come to church, and he used to go up, and he used to talk, and he used to preach, and he used to everything, and the whole community was accepting of it. Then again, we went, when my grandmother was feeling ill, we decided to come here, and we went to a church here, and it was completely the different other view. He had a dress and a suit, he had his hair, he had his hair underneath a hat, so people wouldn't know, and he had to hide that from them. That was the first time I've ever seen my uncle have to hide something that he was. So it was really almost a culture shock for me, because I was so used to him being so flamboyant and so out in the community, for him to come out here, and I thought would be the same community and be completely the opposite, the polar opposite of it. So it kind of does deter sometimes. But Some people might not agree, but when I see the head of a family for a white person, for a white family, it's predominantly the man, the male, the father that's the head of the family. In the black community, it's definitely the big grandmother. The grandmother, the woman, she is the head of the family, and whatever she says goes. And mothers are a little bit more accepting sometimes. It might take them time to get there, but they're a little bit more accepting. So that's why I think that sometimes the smaller communities, or in the black communities, that is a little bit more accepting for them, because they're so used to having the mother, the nurturer, the one being the head of the family. But for the white family, it's more of the macho, masculine, you know, you are to be who you are, and, you know, go team spirit, you know, all that stuff. So that's why I think it was a little bit of a culture shock seeing the two diversities and thinking that you were in the same community and actually you were in a completely different community. So I think it's definitely, like, the difference between being up here in Nova Scotia and being in a black community and being down in Louisiana and being in a black community, it's completely two different things, right? So, you know, it's different in every place.
Anything to add?
Yeah, Sharon, I've been trying for the longest time to get to that book, and I just can't remember the author, but I'll look it up. He talked about the making of the West Indies, and that's not what it's called, but it's similar to that. What he chronicles, you know, the social and political thought in the West Indies, and, you know, that's my point of reference. And basically the strength of the woman, and mm-hmm. basically the lack of any sort of power for the black men. He also talked about the fact is that black women have always been at the head of families and have always sort of gotten things done for the black men because of basically their bodies in the time of slavery. They could use their bodies to negotiate resources for their men. He also talked about the fact that black men, basically, the only kind of power that they had was physical, and that's where you have violence. Black men resort into violence whenever they cannot, when they are frustrated. In terms of our society, the Caribbean society, and I know there are parallels to other societies, the strength of the society rested on creating, chattels, human as livestock to carry on the farm, to carry on the work that was done during the time of slavery. Now, in order to do that, a man had to be able to procreate. He had to be able to have children. For women, it has always been a different kind of society, in that women can still have children, procreate, and have relationships with other women. With men, it has been a little bit different. Men in the Caribbean, and it continues up to this day, have a sort of duty to have children. Now, if two men were to be engaged in a relationship, living together, this is frowned, well, more than just frowned upon. But if these men were to have fleeting relationships and have a stable heterosexual life, then they would be able to move on. They would be able to live a normal life. People will still say, oh yeah, I know what he does, but at the same time, he would be respected. Now, as we move forward in our thinking, and we move forward as a liberal society, and we all want to express ourselves as being, wholesome and live in the way that we feel that is important to us. That thinking of society way back is still sort of in our system, where we believe that it is kind of unnatural and not a good thing that men, not women, but men should continue a role or to have a role that is anti creating the future society, for lack of a better word. It is basically we need to carry on to procreate, to continue the race, the system, the people, and by shirking our duties of not creating and procreating, then that becomes a problem. And I think that this is the issue where homophobia comes in. In many societies, you can continue to have a normal life if you continue what is seen as a heterosexual existence. But to have to embrace a partner, to live in a situation where you think it is okay, which it is okay, our society is not yet ready at that, is not yet at that stage. And it's just in the similar way that many of the systems that we have here that are oppressive to us as Black people in our social and political lives come back from way back there in the oppressions that we've had. And it's very similar to our oppression of gays and lesbians, etc. It just continues. I will try to get you the reference, and yeah, it's a very, very good book. Yeah.
Well, Clemen, we will give you the last word because of our timing. And
hi, I'm Jackie DeHagen. Hi, everybody. I'm an out, queer, tall, urban dwelling
Black man.
Black man.
Are you transitioning?
So, thank you all for being here. It's wonderful to see such a great turnout. I had asked Catherine at the very beginning to do thank yous, but because we're now out of time, I'm just going to quickly go through these, if I may.
Yeah.
Thank you. So I'd like to thank Mark Braithwaite from he's the Vice President Student Services at Dal for the lovely food. If there's more food, you must stay and eat it all. You cannot leave, they will lock the doors until the food is gone. I would like to thank our friends and colleagues from the Nova Scotia Advisory Commission on AIDS, in particular Lori, Michelle, Larry, and Norma for their great work in putting this whole and on behalf of the organizing committee for this particular event, I would like to express my sincere thanks to the organizing committee. I wonder if you guys could just so we know who you are. Sharon, don't make me go over there, because that's great. Including Clem George, who's my dear friend and colleague who came all the way from Toronto this morning. I'm thrilled to have you here, Clem. Thank you for that. Thank you to our other panelists for being here. It's incredible. And I take your point, Chris, that we need to have these conversations more frequently. And I think Brenda's question about how do we do this in a way that's actually a learning or teachable moment for others, I think we need to continue to have these conversations. So I certainly hope this will not be the end of this conversation.
partner and you did not have a choice. Other than that, you know, choice is what we do with your time, and I'm just really thankful that you chose to pretend that I didn't just get a piece of paper. I don't multitask very well. But I do want to thank all of you for coming. I think it is important, and it's good to have you here. I was just handed a piece of paper reminding folks that there's a fundraiser at Company House tonight where Faith Nolan, who is originally from our community, lesbian social activist, is performing, and proceeds go to Stepping Stone. And so if you have a chance to go there on, and it's $10. All $10, I'm sure, will go towards Stepping Stone, and that's great. As a final word, I do want to say that I really hope that our community, and really anyone who believes in Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s dream, will rise to Coretta Scott King's challenge, right? And will make room at the table of brotherhood and sisterhood for...